slightly behind, and we'll try to be on schedule as best we can. I am very happy to be here, and I think this is an important committee. We want to work towards prosperity in our state and providing new jobs and good incomes for our people. So I think we're all in, we're all of one mind about that, and that is our goal. I'd like to introduce my committee members to you. In fact, I'm going to let them introduce themselves briefly and where they're from.
Mike Schaffler, Happy Valley.
Bill Garage, District 56, which is Klamath Falls.
I'm Diane Rosenbaum. I'm from Hess District 42 in southeast and northeast Portland, and did serve as the vice chair of this committee last time and really enjoyed being able to work in a bipartisan manner to produce, I think, some of the most significant bills of the session. So I'm really looking forward to working with you and the other committee members again this session.
Thank you, Diane. I'm Representative Betsy Close from Albany, Millersburg, Tangent, parts of Corvallis.
Representative Eric Kitts from Hillsborough.
Representative Jeff Murphy from East Portland, District 47.
Mary Gallegos, House District 29, which is Forest Grove, Cornelius, and Hillsborough.
And we'll try not to slaughter Mary's name too badly.
I'll just remind you.
I'd like to introduce my committee staff, the very able Jim Stembridge. And Jim, would you like to make some comments?
Well, yeah, I appreciate the members' patience. This is our organizational meeting, and your staff, it's not just for the members to get organized, it's also for the staff to get organized. So we have been working hard on all the little details that maybe you hadn't noticed before today, because we're learning how to do them ourselves, and appreciate it. Pam Cox is our committee assistant. Linda Gatto's helping out today, and I think you saw Patricia Nielsen here also, our continuing staff. Works to get session staff comfortable in their new jobs. And as you know, the Oregon Legislature reorganizes every 2 years, and lots of people come in starting from scratch. And so it's a big job to get us going. So appreciate your patience in affording us this organizational time. I did want to say also that committee staff is here to serve all members. I work primarily for the chair of the committee, and so does Pam, but we're also happy to do any research that members have, that kind of thing. Of course, there may be time constraints that we'll have to deal with, but please let us know if you have any thing related to committees or issues in committee that we can assist with.
Thank you, and welcome to Pam Cox, our very able staff. Okay, I'll just say a few things about meeting times. We are meeting at 8:30 in the morning with hoping to go have a two-hour meeting, but when session begins to work back in time, we may go to 8 o'clock in the morning, but I will try, for those who live in Portland and commute, we will try to keep it at 8:30 as long as we can. I did ask for afternoon, but I was not successful in that attempt. We will try to meet on time, and if we go over time on bills, for those in the lobby, we will try to let you know when we're going to get to your bill so that you can leave the room and come back if you need to. Please let us know your needs, let the staff know your needs as those come up. If you're going to be absent on committee, if you can let us know, we'd appreciate it. We have to have a quorum to do work, so just let me know. I'd like to have a 24-hour notice. This is what I tell my four children. If you're going to have somebody over, could you give me 24 hours? So that works for me. If you have to leave the room, and I know from time to time people don't feel well and want to watch on their TVs, that's okay with me as long as we have at least the people here to form a quorum, and also the decorum that witnesses aren't coming up to the table and there's one person sitting here. That's sometimes offensive, so try to work with us on that. The jurisdiction of the committee, we've submitted a list to the Speaker's Office of the bills that we would like to have in this committee. That's, of course, their option, and we are requesting bills when we can. So, let me know if there's a bill that has not been assigned that you would like us to request for this committee. We'll be considering committee bills as well, and I'm not sure exactly what those will be at this point, but we have had discussions about possible committee bills. That good thing about committee bills is, no one's name is on it. We do it as a group, and that works very well sometimes for helping a bill get through the process. Okay, I'd like to go to committee rules. Everybody has a copy in front of you. These are just your plain vanilla rules. I'm tempted to read down them, but because of time, we probably don't need to do that. Does anybody have a question about these rules or a comment?
Madam Chair, I have a question.
Representative Merkley.
Thank you. The rule that caught my attention was number 12. In the middle of the paragraph, it notes that, number 13, that proposed amendments need to be submitted 48 hours prior to the work session at which they're being considered. I think, given we may not even know the bills until 24 hours, will it be possible to waive that when we're working on legislation and getting amendments drafted?
This rule, I also questioned with my staff. It is not something that I have put in there. This is something that's come from the chief clerk's office. So I'd like Jim to comment on that.
I'm told that that rule has always been there, and you'll notice that amendments by other than members of the legislative assembly applies to only amendments that come from other than members. So any amendments you brought or any other member brought, and that's, as you know, there's only two sources for amendments. One is from members. The other is the committee itself. So it only applies to committee amendments. So I agree the rule itself doesn't, I don't quite understand the reason for the rule and all that, because a lot of times, as you know, we'll meet here at 8:30 and we're expecting amendments and they haven't come yet. They'll come at 9:15. You know, that's quite different from 48 hours prior. Mm-hmm. So in the past, this rule has, to the best of my knowledge, never been invoked. At times, we have amended it to say that the chair may waive the rule, but if we wanted to do that, we would need to check with the chief clerk of the House, because these are the standard rules that all the committees are adopting.
All right. Okay, thank you.
Well, Madam Chair, it doesn't seem like a big problem, because with this explanation, if the only member that can move an amendment would be a member of the committee, it seems like you're already out from under it by virtue of working with somebody who would support your amendment who serves as a member. So, I mean, it seems a little silly to me, I guess, because of that, but I don't see it as a big problem.
Okay. Further discussion? Seeing none, Representative Kitts.
Yes, I move to approve the rules as adopted.
Representative Kitts has moved that we adopt the committee rules as we have before us. Is there objection? Seeing none, so ordered. Adopted the rules. Stick those away in your file.
Representative Close, we had invited Representative Knope and Senator Beyer to make a presentation on what the business committees on both chambers had accomplished during the 2001 session. There was a leadership meeting called, and neither one of those legislators can be here. They may be here later, so I suggest we move on ahead, and then if they haven't arrived, you can decide whether you want to wait for them or if you want to schedule that another time, or the administrator from the House committee last session could fill in.
Okay, I think we will skip over that. I know that they did check with me. They had other meetings that were important. So we won't have that at this point. Is Cheryl Pellegrini with us? Would you come forward, please? Cheryl is going to talk to us about, she is from the Department of Justice, and she's going to talk about their Financial Fraud and Consumer Protection Division and what they've been doing. Welcome.
Good morning. Chair Close, members of the committee, thank you very much for asking us to come. My name, for the record, is Cheryl Pellegrini. I am the attorney in charge of the Financial Fraud and Consumer Protection section of the Department of Justice. And the section is part of the Department's Civil Enforcement Division, and that does most of the plaintiff's work on behalf of the state of Oregon. Just a little bit about our section. We're made up of 10 attorneys, 7 investigators, 5 enforcement officers, consumer coordinator, a volunteer coordinator, and support staff. About a third of our budget is funded through general fund allotment, and the rest we generate ourselves through the enforcement actions that we take. Our enforcement actions also return millions of dollars every year to Oregonians in the form of restitution. I don't have the final figures for 2002, but I can tell you that as a result of one case alone, Oregonians will be receiving $8 million back in restitution.
And what was the subject of that investigation?
That's Chair Close, that's the household finance case that was just concluded in December. It was a predatory lending case targeting subprime mortgage borrowers.
Multi-state.
It was a multi-state, yes. For more than 20 years, Oregonians having problems in the marketplace have turned to government for assistance. Consumers and business alike call the Attorney General's hotline to file complaints or find out how to file complaints about alleged unlawful activities, but also to check on a company's history or just to get information. Between 1980 and 1996, the hotline was staffed by only three enforcement officers, and they answered phones from 8:30 to 1 and then worked complaints the rest of the day. In 1996, we recruited volunteers and we trained them to answer the hotline in order to give our enforcement officers, who are permanent staff, more time to work on actual written complaints. About half a dozen volunteers staffed four lines until noon every day. Under Attorney General Myers' administration, we hired a full-time volunteer coordinator in 1997, and she designed and implemented a consumer advocate program to staff the hotline. Currently, we have about 70 volunteers that fill 90 shifts a week. They run three shifts a day. And then in the off hours, consumers will call the hotline use an informational phone tree that's available in both English and Spanish with pre-recorded messages about various subjects of interest. In July 99, we established a toll-free hotline, which we staffed 8:30 to noon 5 days a week, and in that year, 1999, we got 64,000 phone calls. In April 2000, we expanded the hotline staffing to 7 hours a day, 5 days a week. I'm sorry to say that we don't have accurate stats for that year because that was the year that we converted to a new system to accurately track the number of calls that came in, record them on a computer, and then print them out. In 2001, we received 72,436 calls to the system. With this last year, we received 72,617 calls into the system, and of those, 56,729 callers talked to a live person. Our volunteers spent 4,113 hours on the phone last year talking to consumers. We don't record complaints that come in over the hotline. In order to be counted, a complaint has to come in written form, either through the mail or now we have a service that's available online. Often consumers call the hotline to find out how to file a complaint, so there's a probable correlation between the number of complaints we get written and the number of calls we get on the hotline. What have we heard in the last year? And what I'm going to tell you about now is what we've heard from consumers that we've taken from the written complaints that we've received from them. We do a top 10 list of consumer complaints. It comes out in February, so I don't have final numbers, but I think that what we can give you at this point is a pretty good idea of which industries are going to be on the list. The total complaints that we received, these are written complaints in 2002, 17,405. That's up about 3,000 complaints from 2001. Telecommunications will top our top 10 for the second year in a row, and we think that they're going to come in at almost three times the amount of complaints as are in the number two category. Most of the complaints are about local and long-distance providers, although I will tell you that we are now starting to receive an increasing number of complaints about wireless providers. And we suspect that that's because a lot of people are switching from landlines to wireless lines as their primary means of telecommunications.
Excuse me, so is this, what we're talking about here is spamming?
Representative Close, no, these, standing's in its category all by itself.
Okay.
These are complaints about being slammed from one long-distance provider to another, being billed for services that you never ordered or for calls that you never made, terminating service but still being billed for services, stuff like that.
And excuse me, you probably said this, but what percentage of the total calls was what you just said? Being changed from one company to another?
I don't have, 932 so far.
Out of 17,000?
No, out of 17,405, our preliminary number for telecommunications as a whole is 2,850.
Okay.
And then within those, there are different categories. There's long distance, about 900. Local service, about 975. Cellular is up in the 650 range. And then various other is high 200s. Just a note about slamming, we do continue to receive a lot of complaints about telephone long-distance slamming, and I just point out that for this reason, the Attorney General Myers has decided to reintroduce a slamming bill, which is Senate Bill 120, to provide a direct remedy for consumers.
Cheryl, will you give us the definition of slamming?
Sure. Representative Close, slamming occurs when a long-distance company that you're not contracting with moves you from your current long-distance provider to it without your consent and with no notice to you. Often, the first time you would find out that you've been slammed is when you get your phone bill and you see an unfamiliar long-distance provider with a very large monthly fee.
Now, can you tell me... legally, do they have to have a written signature to do that? Do they have to have an oral agreement? Is there anything in the law that says what they have to have?
I believe, Representative Close, that the FCC rules require either third-party verification via a third-party consent telephone or wet signature. Either is allowed.
Okay.
And Senate Bill 120 would adopt the federal standard.
Okay.
Number two on the list, this is also telephone related, it's no call, that's the telephone's solicitation law. We think that we, Attorney General Myers, has offered greater peace to about 100,000 Oregon households that are currently on the list. The complaints this year have been going down. We like to think it's because we've been very aggressively enforcing this law, but we notice it bumped up a little bit towards the end of the year, but that's also because we got a surge of registrations right before the end of the year. We think that the final number for no-call complaints is going to come in the high 1,200s. Third on the list, Internet auctions, and probably the most popular is eBay. It moved from number 6 in 2001 to number 3 this year. Oregon continues to be one of the top 5 most wired states, and Portland has been listed in tech magazines as in the top 3 of the most wired cities in the United States. So a lot of people are online. The main complaint that we get about internet auctions, of course, is that people bargain for an item, they pay, they don't get it. We also get a lot of these complaints in addition to coming in from Oregonians. We get a lot that come in through a national internet fraud complaint center. So we actually get complaints and resolve complaints for consumers across the country doing business with Oregon businesses as well as Oregonians doing business with businesses outside of Oregon.
So, Cheryl, if you get this type of complaint, then eBay or whatever, can you walk us through how you help that consumer?
Sure, as best I can. Representative Close, what we will usually do is immediately find out the most effective way to get at the offending seller is to find out where they're actually located and then to contact their internet service provider and notify the internet service provider, many of whom have regulations that if you're on eBay, they're providing you internet service, you don't deliver as promised, they'll cut off your service. So we'll often get in touch with both the seller and their internet service provider, tell the seller we know that they haven't delivered the product, demand that they do so, at the same time report them to their internet service provider, and I'd say in 98% of the cases that resolves it. Number four on the list, the Nigerian money transfer scheme. I don't know how many of you might have received either by fax or by email a letter from an African national or someone who's in Kenya advising that they have a large amount of money that they've received that they need to park in a foreign bank account, and that for the privilege of parking it in your bank account, they would be willing to give you several hundred thousand dollars. The only thing they need, of course, is your bank account number. This is an advance, what we used to call an advance fee scam, where people, a con, will ask you for money up front with the promise of investing it and giving you a lot of money back, or giving you access to a lot of funds, and you never get it. The sad thing is that a lot of people fall for this. In fact, there's a federal task force whose sole purpose is to find the perpetrators of this scheme and federally prosecute them. And the last figures that I saw were in 1998. But back then, people were sending in over $2 million a year as a result of this scheme and losing that amount. And there have been several people in Oregon.
Representative Kitts has a question.
I need clarification from you. So you're telling me that if someone gave their bank account number, they wouldn't put the money in?
Chair Close, Representative Kitts, that's exactly what I'm telling you.
They're just simply saying, fax me your bank account,
and we'll take the money out.
Okay.
So, Madam Chair, can I ask a question?
Representative.
My question has to do with, what is the actual number of those who are truly giving their bank account number and having a financial loss because of that? I mean, out of the total, maybe that might be complaining about receiving the email.
Sure. Chair Close, Representative Gallegos. I got it right.
Perfect.
That number is being kept by the federal task force. We received over 1,000 complaints. I would say out of the 1,000, about 10 people, 10 to maybe 15, lost over $1,000. And there was one state worker who lost about $200,000.
Is that each person or total of that, the $1,000 that you mentioned, is that each person or total?
Chair Close, Representative Gallegos, that's each.
Oh, okay. Thank you.
Continue.
Number five on the list, we expect it to be magazine subscription services. These are the cards that you get in the mail saying your subscription to Consumer Reports is about to run out. If you sign up now and renew your subscription, you get a big discount. There's a company which we now have a lawsuit pending against that I think is responsible for most of the complaints that we've gotten. This particular company, what it did is that it is not associated with any of the magazine publishers. It's an independent company. And our complaint alleges that the company sent cards to consumers that misled them to believe that they were coming from the actual publishing company, represented that if they renewed now, they would realize a savings, when actually they were paying over 100% more of what the magazine publisher itself would have charged for a renewal of the same magazine. And we think there's up in the high 800s of complaints in that category. And there are other companies too, but this is the main one. Number six on the list, motor vehicle transactions. Motor vehicle sales were number four in 2001, so they have moved down in 2002, although I can't tell you. I think that in actual number of complaints, they're higher, but in comparison with the number of complaints we've received about the other companies above them, they're lower. And in that category, we count complaints against new car dealers, complaints against used car dealers, And then we started to break out complaints about the sale of recreational vehicles, campers, and trailers. The total there is right around 800 complaints.
Can I ask you, Cheryl, do you get complaints about tow companies that are towing vehicles and then selling them?
Representative Close, I would have to check. I know that that is an issue that the Oregon Dealer Advisory Committee, which is housed within the Oregon Department of Transportation's Motor Vehicles Division, has been looking at.
Okay.
But I have to go check before I answered you.
Thank you.
Number seven on the list, credit cards. The worst player we found to be was a nationally chartered bank that issued credit cards for major catalog retailers. And in this category, what we see are two major complaints. One, a charge shows up for product that I never ordered and I never asked for. And two, that the offer that the credit card issuer gave me in terms of my introductory interest rate is not what I ended up being charged. And that we sort of cast as a bait and switch. Total number there, high 600s, about 650, 660 complaints there. The issue here is that if the credit card is issued by a nationally chartered financial institution, there's not a whole lot that the Attorney General's Office can do for consumers within the context of the Unlawful Trade Practices Act because these banks are regulated by the Office of the Comptroller of the Currency and other federal financial institution regulatory agencies. So what we do there is we try to mediate and get the charge removed from the consumer's account more than take any enforcement action against the institution. Number eight, non-store retailing. This does not include internet retailing, but it does include subcategories like mail order, telemarketers, and television infomercials. We received about 630, 645 complaints against those entities. Number nine, internet retailers, excluding auctions. So these are just retail sites that consumers go to on the internet. A variety of problems occur, but by far the biggest is the failure to deliver goods after they've been paid for, and misrepresentations about the quality of goods. Often the picture that's up on the site is very different than the good that you get through the mail after you pay for it. We got about 480 complaints in that category. Finally, number 10, collection agencies. This is number 10 again, and it first appeared on our top 10 in 2000. The two categories of complaints include violations of the Fair Debt Collection Practices Act, such as collection agents calling after hours, threatening to sue or harm people if they don't pay up, and calling them at their place of employment.
And how many, what were the number of complaints on that one?
It was about 400. And then just as an interesting note, we dropped down to who would be number 11, and we found that it's a category that we call advertising agents, but you may know them better as fax blasters. They're the unsolicited pieces of material that y'all get through your faxes. And we've got almost 400 of those last year. New on the horizon, finally, spam complaints. We've got 200 of them this year. And we would note that despite the best efforts of internet service providers to provide their customers with features that block out unwanted emails, we continue, or small businesses especially, are being really hard hit by unwanted commercial bulk email. And I would also note that Attorney General Myers, in response to the increase in this sort of communication, has introduced Senate Bill 121, and that's Oregon's version of a canned spam law, and its pattern, unlike all of the other spam laws that the different states have adopted, ours would be patterned after our telecommunications or telephone solicitor no-call law. So you may be seeing that bill this session, we hope.
Can I just ask you briefly what your solution was to that problem in that bill?
Yes. What the bill would do, Chair Close, would be to set up a list that would be administrated by a private list administrator, just like our no-call law currently is, and consumers would just sign up their email address for 1 year at a time on the list before commercial bulk emailing into Oregon. A company would have to get a copy of the list, perform a search and cross-check function, scrub their mailing list of any email addresses that are present on our no-spam list, and then go ahead and email into the state. We realize that the big challenge here is going to be enforcement. We know that. And we've been talking to our counterparts in the Washington Attorney General's office. They have a no-spam law that is more in the nature of a disclosure law. And so we've been talking with them about the best ways that they found to enforce their law.
Madam Chair, Representative Garrard, and then Gallegos.
Good morning, Ms. Pellegrini. Are the areas of the state that you receive complaints from proportionate with population? In other words, does basically everyone in the state have the opportunity, and how much are you working with people around the state or just from population centers?
Sure. Chair Close, Representative Garrard, we receive complaints from consumers across the state. We have a toll-free hotline, and consumers now have the ability to file online, and I think that really has facilitated people that don't live right here between, you know, Portland and Roseburg in filing complaints. The cases that we do, you know, manufactured housing is a great example. I mean, we get complaints about manufactured housing dealers, or we have been, they're way down, but in the past we have, and they're all over the state. It just is, you know, wherever folks bought their home and rented space in parks is where the complaints came from. A group of itinerant vacuum cleaner salesmen that were preying on elderly citizens, and they were located almost exclusively in the Baker area. So we went out there and we actually filed a complaint, a racketeering complaint against them, and tried them out there, and I think that we got about $100,000 in civil penalties against them. So we sort of go wherever the activity is, and it appears to be everywhere.
Representative Gallegos, excuse me.
Thank you. My question has to do with the Senate Bill 121 and the technology requirements to monitor or be able to. Does the state actually have the technology available to be able to do that, or another state have an example that's already working and in place of how they would monitor and be able to post the email addresses for another company to be able to get those? Is there?
Chair Close, Representative Gallegos, the state itself does not have the technology, but nor do we have the technology to run the no-call program. What we do is that we contract with a private company, list administrator, in the no-call for the no-call program, and that list administrator is responsible for building the technology. And it doesn't cost the state anything, at least it didn't in the no-call program, because what we did was we entered into a contract with the list administrator. They're responsible for providing the technology, building the system, and they were allowed to collect the fees from consumers to sign up. It's like $6.50 a year, $3 for the year thereafter, and then telemarketers to buy the list, and it was $120 per year to buy the list. So we envision a similar system for the no-spam law. And again, I think that Washington is running it outside of the Attorney General's office, so we're going to talk to them about, you know, how they set theirs up and how it's been running.
Thank you. Representative Schaffler.
Thanks for coming. Are you going to get us this info? I didn't scribble all this stuff down. It's an incredible amount of information. Can you get that to us, all the stats you just gave us?
Representative...
And I have more than this stat.
Sure. Chair Close, Representative Schaffler, I had intended before I came over to give you one page fast facts, but I had technical difficulty.
Was it spam?
No, I think it was operator error, I'm afraid.
I've gotten the Nigerian letter into my mailbox, too, so I've got hit three times. But, and I stopped the phone solicitations and through the phone company, not through the Attorney General's thing, but and it works great. We don't get calls at dinner time anymore. You mentioned a number of 4,000 hours in 1 year of volunteer.
Mm-hmm.
That was one person?
Oh, no.
I was going to say.
Oh, no.
Man,
no.
We
don't
like
work them that hard.
One person did that.
I'm sorry. No, we have, currently we have about 70 volunteers.
Mm.
And they're mostly persons who have retired, so they'll be here for part of the year, and then they'll leave and come back. Those 70 people, they work 90 shifts
a week. I thought you said
they work 3 hours a day, and we usually have a bank of 7 phones answering the hotline, and so usually there's 7 volunteers,
mm-hmm.
7. Sometimes 8.
They put in 4,000 hours.
They collectively put in 4,119 hours last year.
Thank you.
Representative Rosenbaum.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Cheryl, I'm curious what the overlap might be between this consumer complaint process and other agencies that might regulate in some of these areas, and specifically the telecommunications complaints. I mean, a lot of those could also, it seems like, be complaints to the Public Utility Commission. So do you coordinate with them? Do you suggest that people call the PUC in certain cases, or how does that sort itself out?
Sure. Chair Close, Representative Rosenbaum, we do coordinate with the PUC. In fact, there was a case that we investigated, and we obtained an assurance of voluntary compliance against Quest, the local service provider for much of Oregon, and we worked in conjunction with the PUC there. What was happening was consumers were complaining to us about some practices. They were notifying the PUC about others. So there's a consumer, I don't know what their title is, but there's a consumer part of the PUC that we deal with a lot. And so they called us, we met, we actually went through and cross-checked names to make sure that we each had the same list of consumer complaints. And then we essentially decided which complaints the PUC was in a better position to correct because they were more regulatory in nature, and which complaints were about things like slamming, which was more an enforcement issue for us.
Cheryl, go ahead.
Just one follow-up. Thank you. Is there a connection between this process and the class action types of litigation that the department engages in? Because it seems like there's some highly publicized cases that don't fall into any of these categories, like the one that just happened with the pharmaceutical, I can't remember what the drug was.
Zithromax.
Right.
Right. Chair Close, Representative Rosenbaum, great observation. What consumers complain about, that tells us, you know, what they're getting, and it informs us to some extent, and to some extent will drive the enforcement actions we take. But a perfect example is that Nigerian scam. I mean, we got over 1,000 complaints, but we're not going to take our limited resources and try to track down one of the, there's probably over 200 perpetrators of this scheme. A bunch of people use it. So we get a lot of complaints, but doesn't necessarily mean we're going to take an enforcement action. The Pfizer case, the Zithromax case, was one where one of our assistant attorney generals noticed an article in the paper that appeared to give rise to the suspicion that they were misrepresenting the efficacy of Zithromax to treat otitis media, kids' inner ear infections. And so we opened an investigation based on that. And we did that in conjunction with a number of other states that was a multi-state group. That the multi-state process is where we also will focus a lot of our enforcement efforts, as opposed to taking in consumer complaints and assisting individual consumers in resolving their complaints with a business. Most of our antitrust actions, for example, are all multi-state, either because it's a review of two merging companies, and we've done a lot of petroleum mergers, or because it's a case that involves a company or an industry that operates either regionally or nationwide.
So. Thank you. Please continue.
I've taken up a lot of your time. Thank you very much. I just had one more thing to say, if I could, about one other issue on the horizon that you might be hearing about this session, and that's identity theft.
Oh.
It's a massive problem in Oregon, but we're not alone. It's a huge problem nationally as well. We have a criminal statute that identifies identity theft as a felony. I think that was passed in 1999, perhaps. The problem here is, well, there's several problems. One, that identity thieves will take personal information of a person in Oregon and sell it to somebody in Arkansas who will use it in Massachusetts. So it's really hard to track and locate the suspects and the perpetrators. The other problem is one for the victims of identity theft, and that is that it takes on average more than 3 years to clear your credit history and your credit cards and records with other financial institutions as a result of being victimized. And that's because different pieces of your personal information can be resold and retooled to create new identities. So just as you think that you've cleared up your credit history with Experian, you know, you'll get your credit report from TransUnion and find out that there's a credit card that's been issued that you've never seen before that's already maxed out. As a result of identity theft, Attorney General Myers is introducing, in order to better combat it, we're introducing three bills this session that focus on this crime. The first is House Bill 2119 that adds identity theft to the list of predicate offenses for the Oregon Racketeering and Influence and Corrupt Organizations Act, or RICO. House Bill 2103 would require any merchant who takes a credit card and issues a receipt to obliterate all but the last four numbers of the credit or debit card. And you probably know, if you've gone to some of the bigger retailers, they're already doing that. The final one is House Bill 2105, and that would provide for one free credit report from each of the credit agencies per year per Oregonian. Currently, there's a fee, and it ranges from, you know, $8 to $25, I think, depending on how you get the report. But this would allow anyone preventatively every year to get copies of their credit report to make sure that there are no suspicious or unfamiliar entries on your report. Again, thank you so much for your time.
Can I ask a question?
Question, Representative Schaffler.
Just for the record, I'm a new guy too, but how are you funded? If you had to make any staff cuts due to revenue shortages, and will the failing or passage of Measure 28 have an impact on your staff and staff levels and your ability to go after these bad guys?
Chair Close, Representative Schaffler, that's a question that's much better answered by Attorney General Myers than I, because as the head of the Department of Justice, it is he who would make the decision about what staffing cuts, if any, are made as a result of the failure of that bill. But I can tell you about how we're funded. About one-third of our operating funds come from a general fund allotment, mm-hmm. but the other two-thirds we raise directly through the enforcement actions that we take against businesses who break the law. Mm-hmm. And what we do is we try to shift as much as we can onto those companies the cost of our investigation and try to pay for as much as of our overhead as we can. In addition to doing that because it saves taxpayers money, we also do it in the nature of a financial penalty in the hopes that it will provide enough of a deterrent so that the business won't commit that sort of unlawful conduct in the future.
May I go on, or is that okay?
Well, Representative Schaffler, we don't want to get into Measure 28 in this
point. Forgive me, I didn't mean to do that. May I ask... May I rephrase the question? Have you seen any staff cuts yourself due to lack of revenue in the department?
Chair Close, Representative Schaffler, not so far, but I will tell you we're pretty lean to begin with. And to the extent that we can, we have tried very, very hard to find volunteers, like the 70 volunteers that staff the hotline, and to try to draw on community resources to get our work done. We often partner with the industries that we take enforcement actions against. Again, I'll use the manufactured housing industry as one. There was a big rise in complaints in the year 99, and so Attorney General Myers convened a task force in 2000, and as a result of that task force, the industry and the Department of Justice came together to identify the practices that were causing the biggest problems for both consumers and for lawful and legitimate dealers and manufacturers. And we targeted those both with a series of bills that were jointly supported by the industry and consumer groups, as well as more narrowly tailored enforcement actions. So,
as a small business person, I just want to tell you, I hope you good luck. But one of the things, as a small contractor, when you walk on their property, one of the first things you have to overcome is their distrust of contractors, and it makes small business people's jobs and lives much difficult because of these criminals. So good luck to you. You have my support.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Committee, I think we're going to finish up this report, and then we want to get Senator Beyer here if you can. So... could you take 5 minutes to finish?
Chair Close, I was done.
You are finished.
I was done. If there are any more questions, I'd be happy to answer them.
So we'll take 5 minutes for questions, and I can't remember which one of you had your hand up first. Okay. Representative Merkley.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Back to the identity theft question. Do the credit bureaus offer any kind of service to consumers that allow someone to essentially get immediate notification if there's a credit inquiry, and thus would alert them to someone taking out a credit card in their name, that sort of thing?
Chair Close, Representative Merkley. Boy, it's called a red flag. They'll flag your account. I think that they do. It's voluntary. How long the flag stays on varies from reporting agency to reporting agency. And also, Congresswoman Hooley has an identity theft bill in Congress that addresses that very issue, among others. I think it would make it mandatory for credit reporting agencies to flag an account once there's been a report of identity theft, and then to make certain information available to the person for a stated period of time.
Representative Gallegos.
My question was actually on the same lines. In, you know, House Bill 2105, you know, for the free credit report, but are you proposing any solutions to help the consumer through that 3-year process to clean up their credit report, or to know or be alerted that there's other things going on?
Chair Close, Representative Gallegos, the Federal Trade Commission for several years now has an excellent website, and they also offer services. They have written materials, and you can call them, and they will essentially walk you through the process. As well, the Attorney General's office within my office will do the same thing. We don't have any enforcement authority in the area of identity theft because we do civil law. We do civil law enforcement only. Don't have any criminal law enforcement authority under the Unlawful Trade Practices Act. So what we do in that case is we act as a Victims Assistance Agency.
Well, thank you very much for a very informative presentation. I think we'll be able to help our constituents much better knowing that you exist. And we'll try not to overload you. And we will look for these bills that you have told us about.
Thank you.
Great interest.
And I'd be happy to provide a very brief form of what I've told you in writing to all of you.
Thank you.
Thanks again.
The committee will stand at ease for a moment while we discuss our situation with the staff. Other preparers today, Senator Knope and Senator Beyer, are tied up, so we are going to adjourn for today. Thank you for your interest. We are adjourned.
All right.